On this episode of The Big Number, we reveal our way too early NBA award ballots for MVP, Defensive Player of the Year, Rookie of the Year, and more. Plus, we dive into the stats on the injury crisis that's currently plaguing the NBA. All this coming up right now. Welcome, welcome, welcome. Welcome to The Big Number. I am Tom Haberstroh, and as always, I am joined by your man, Dan Devine. Dan, how are you?
I'm doing well, Tom. I'm working through some neck crick issues. I've got kind of a pain in my neck. A lot of teams around the NBA dealing with some pains and some aches and some injuries, but I'm playing through it. The stars got to show up, right? And here I am. So I'm ready to put up some numbers, Tom. Hit me with it. What is today's big number?
This week's big number is 56. That is the number of points that Shai Gilgeous-Alexander has scored in clutch situations this year. 56 points. Ooh. Leads the NBA by a country mile. 56 with no one else more than 40. And the reason why I'm bringing this up is Shai Gilgeous-Alexander is my pick for the MVP of the NBA so far 1 month in. We're going to do one month awards here, Dan. We're coming up to Thanksgiving here, and we're pretty much at 1 month mark here in the NBA. And I feel like today got lots to get into around the league and the injury crisis to stars, and LeBron came back. But I want to kind of pick up the vibes a little bit here and do a show on the awards. So we'll do MVP, we'll do Rookie of the Year, Defensive Player of the Year, Most Improved Player of the Year, and Sixth Man of the Year. We're going to kick things off, Dan, with MVP, which is maybe the most contentious of all of those awards. And I'm going to go with Shai, the guy who's leading the 14-1 Oklahoma City Thunder with the best point differential in the NBA at 15.5 points every 100 possessions, their net rating. And the guy is incredible in clutch situations this year, mostly like in the first two games of the season. He's got 56 points in 39 clutch minutes. And no one else has more than 40, just to reiterate that. And his true shooting percentage in clutch situations is absurd. He's been electric when they need him to be. And they've needed him quite a bit because this team has had zero games with J-Dub, Jalen Williams out on the floor. A handful of missed games from Alex Caruso, Chet Holmgren, Isaiah Joe. They've had the second most games lost due to injury in the NBA. And they're 14-1. So, Dan, I kind of feel like there's a lot of people voting for Jokic, a lot of people voting for Luka. My board right now, I'll just say, is Shai, Jokic, Wemby, Luka, and Giannis at the 1 month mark. Dan, what say you?
Well, you've put me in the unenviable position of having to say, voting for the reigning MVP, who's the best player on the best team in the league, is a bad choice. It's not a bad choice.
I didn't say you had to do that, Dan.
Right. Well, I mean, say, but you know what?
That's my guy too.
Right. And then it'd be a pretty short podcast, which I think everybody would be really excited about. But in the interest of having a conversation, here's here's Dan's big number. How about that for our A Block first segment? It's 0.441, which is how many win shares per 48 minutes Jokic is averaging this season. That would be an all-time record to an almost laughable degree. There have only been 14 seasons where someone's been plus 300, or 0.300 rather, and he's at 0.441. Also, in fairness, Shai would also break this record. He's at 0.375. So, yes, these are kind of the two guys that are head and shoulders above the rest of the class. Jokic is on pace to set the all-time record for win shares per 48, also the all-time record for player efficiency rating and box plus minus. He's flirting with the all-time record in true shooting percentage, averaging a 29-point triple-double while leading the league in rebounding and assists, and is leading the number two offense in the NBA. The Nuggets are also the number five defense in the NBA, which is nuts, and he's like the prime mover on all of that. Obviously, Shai is as well, and weirdly, the supporting cast in Denver, that's always been kind of the argument in favor of Jokic. He's rolling up these dramatic on-court, off-court splits because he had no help. the second unit's been pretty rad in Denver so far this year. They've had healthy players who have been really good. Now they're dealing with Christian Brown being out, but Jonas Valanciunas has been helpful. Tim Hardaway Jr. has been awesome off the bench. Aaron Gordon's there. This might be the Jamal Murray all-star year. So there's been a lot of support for him there. He's just been like even better than the best guy in the league for the last handful of years. So to me, I look at it and I'm like, there's one team that's really, with respect to the Rockets, don't want to give them short shrift. There's really one team that's chasing the rabbit in Oklahoma City, and it's Denver, and it's because of Jokic. So I put him at the top of the ballot. But yeah, I mean, the fact that SGA has all those clutch points and he's barely played, not even clutch minutes, but like late game minutes in like a month is really, really wild. We are shaping up for another incredible run here. And one of those situations where like there isn't really a right answer.
Yeah.
Or a wrong answer, all, rather.
They're all right answers, right? I feel like if you want to vote for Luka, I don't have a great argument against it besides just that Shea and Jokic have played more at a high level, more games at a high level. Jokic is insane. Last year, I think we did it on this show, right? That Steph Curry might be the greatest offensive player since Michael Jordan. Yeah. And you could say the same for Jokic. Like a guy who's leading the NBA in assists per game and is shooting 79% on twos and 40% on threes and like the best passer, rebounder. And we're just like, yeah, maybe there's another guy who deserves MVP is just wild. But that's where we're at with the league with at the very top. It's hard to argue that this isn't just like the best era in terms of the skill of these players. It's absurd. And so, yeah, you got Jokic, Shea, then Giannis, Luka, and Wemby. You could just shuffle those, kind of pull that slot machine, and any of those in any order, you have a pretty good case. But Shea, the thing about him that I just keep coming back to is how solid he is. How consistent he is. His numbers, 31.9 points per game, 6.7 assists, 4.9 rebounds, and 1.7 turnovers per game.
Yeah. It's that was one when we were covering the finals last year and it was Thunder versus Pacers, there was one of the most interesting things was the dynamic between SGA and Tyrese Halliburton, that they have that same superpower of you can be super high usage, super efficient in terms of facilitating and scoring the ball, but also like you never turn the ball over. And so for Shea to be that level of I don't turn the ball over and one of the most efficient high volume scorers we've ever seen is truly bonkers. And you're right, we live in an age of monsters. Like these guys, all of them have a chance to go down among the 15, 20 greatest players we've ever seen if they continue along their paths. Just a quick shout out to Giannis. I feel like he gets short shrift in these conversations. It's too short shrift in a very short period of time. I apologize, everybody. But Giannis, it's like we've kind of just been like, oh, well, yeah, that's what that is. And you get used to it and you're somewhat inured to it because we've been watching it for so long. Now he's going to fall back in the conversation out of sight, out of mind with the groin strain rather. It's hard to keep my strains straight at this point. but the groin strain is going to have him likely out for multiple weeks. And maybe by the time he comes back, he's missed more games than will allow him to be eligible for year-end awards eligibility, whatever. But we can talk about it now. He was averaging better than 32 points, 11 rebounds, and 7 assists, career-high 7 assists a game on 663 true shooting when he got hurt. It was like the thing I kept thinking about watching the way this Bucks roster was constructed and the way it was effectively playing out around him. We had talked about the challenges of that supporting cast. Like it really didn't feel like a great supporting cast around him. It looked like when you just build a LeBron team and say, surround him with shooters and let him figure it out. But what if LeBron was like 3 inches taller and somehow even more physically imposing? Like it was unbelievable to watch and has been, and I hope it continues to be, and we get back to watching it very soon. Third place on a ballot like this feels unfair for a performer at that level. These are the levels at which the highest order of the NBA are playing right now, though. And Jokic and SGA feel like they're kind of out head and shoulders above everybody else, even historically great performers like Giannis.
Yeah, I think Giannis is doing the most with the least of these performers here. Shea Gilgeous-Alexander is someone that I don't think we attribute to being like a defensive monster, even though he was right up on the top. steals guys last year and his blocks per game this year. He is an argument to be right there with MJ and Dwayne Wade as the best shot blocking guards in NBA history. He's certainly one of the best defensive guards in the league. And Giannis, he still has a worse supporting cast with, you know, Shai Gilgeous-Alexander having all those injuries to his team. They have the second most injuries in the NBA, and Denver has the least. And so they have six games lost due to injury, which seems like a clerical error that it's that few number of games. And the Thunder have 88, according to SpotTrack.com. So in a weird way, Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, like you pointed out, his lack of a supporting cast has really helped his case this year, and all the injuries and no Jalen Williams, Chet Holmgren, again, a bunch of injuries to the supporting cast. Whereas Jokic, the Christian Brown thing, that hasn't really kind of taken hold yet. And so that is kind of misleading that they've only had six games lost due to injury this season. But I just, look, they've been blowing the doors off of teams. Shai Gilgeous-Alexander has played in six fourth quarters, the 14th games.
Now that seemed like a clerical error. I felt like I had to go back and search that and like make sure the filters were right on NBA.com. Like, wait, only six fourth quarters? And like, and remember, the season started with they had those back-to-back overtime games, right? Like it was against Houston and Indiana, and you're like, oh man, Shai's going to get so worn down if he's got to do everything into these deep games. And it's like, our answer for that is we will never play a close game again. We'll just be, with the exception of on the second night of a back-to-back in Portland on a road trip, that's when we'll get got. But outside of that, what if we blow everybody out before the fourth quarter, then he gets to rest really clean. This, drop the from the Facebook.com. It's cleaner that way. They've really streamlined the process.
Yeah, it's absurd that he's gotten to these numbers while resting in eight fourth quarters of 14 games. So look, 15 games, six fourth quarters there, the stat from StatMuse. Shai has been that guy. The team stuff, the box score stuff, the advanced metrics, they all love Shai this season. And given the supporting cast and the way that they've gotten out to a historic start here, I'm going to give it to Shai. And we're going to talk about LeBron, who's now entered the chat. And, you know, Luka's MVP candidacy gets a little bit more complicated now that Austin Reeves and LeBron James are next to him. We're going to talk about his return and the fact that Jalen Williams is one of, I think, seven stars who haven't played a game yet this season because of injuries. And injuries are way higher than normal at this point in the season. We're going to talk about that, the story I wrote for Yahoo earlier this week. But you know what? After the break, I want to hear your rookie of the year, your defensive player of the year, most improved six man, and compare our notes here. Even though you're not just disagreeing for a good show, right? You're not. This is pure meritocracy on your list. This is not.
That's exactly right.
Embrace debate, right?
No, I would never. I eschew debate at all opportunities. Ask anybody who's ever had to talk to me for more than a couple of minutes. No, I mean, the value of something like this is that it allows us to kind of talk through our thought processes. And I think we're going to wind up in similar places, but maybe with some different names and different orders. And that's a healthy thing. Too much groupthink, no good for anybody. So yeah, let's bat them around. Let's see where we land. And let's talk about some players on the other side of this break.
Let's do it. Let's start off with Rookie of the Year right after the break. All right, Dan. So this week's big number is 56. That's the number of clutch points that Shai Gilgeous-Alexander has scored this season, which is 16 more than anybody else in the league. And yeah, big reason why I have him, how good he's been when they need him to win. He's been awesome. 51% of their points in clutch situations, by the way, are by Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, which bonkers. Is, of course, number one in the league. Same cat, more than half of their points by one guy. So Shai Gilgeous-Alexander is my MVP so far. You got Jokic. We are going to go through the other awards here at the 1 month flagpole. So Dan, let's talk Rookie of the Year. Who do you got first on your fake 1 month ballot?
All right. First little number this week is 14.7. That is how many points per 100 possessions better the Memphis Grizzlies have been this season with Cedric Coward on the floor. as opposed to when he is off it this season. That's the biggest on-off differential on a Grizzlies team that has two all-stars. They guys haven't really been playing like it so much this year in Ja Morant and Jaren Jackson Jr., but Cedric Coward has been fantastic. He is the silver lining in what's been a pretty brutal season thus far in Memphis. They go up to 11 in the draft. They trade up with the Blazers to get up to that pick. They draft Cedric Coward out of Washington State. He's averaging 14.3 points, 6.4 rebounds, and 2.9 assists in 27 minutes per game. 48, 41, 90 shooting splits. So like elite efficiency as a wing player, while also dealing with some really tough defensive covers that he's got to do. According to the B-Ball Index, their positional charting, he's in the 97th percentile in average matchup difficulty so far this season. Jalen Wells takes on, you know, the toughest guy or one of the toughest guys every week, but like he's also dealing with among the toughest nightly responsibilities on the defensive end. That 97th percentile puts him like right in between Cason Wallace and Toumani Kamara. So he's dealing with like a steady diet of elite offensive players that he's got to guard. And while also continuing to increase his offensive responsibilities, he's back or he's in the starting lineup now. I don't think he's coming out of it anytime soon. Yeah. 6 foot six wing, can knock down threes at volume. He can shoot about 70% at the rim. He's creating, facilitating. He's stepping up and guarding high level perimeter guys. So like he is not going to get perhaps as much love for this award as some of the other players we might talk about. I felt like it was a responsible thing to give it to him. Now the advanced stats love him too. But for right now, we'll just say the Memphis Grizzlies have been significantly better with Cedric Coward on the floor. And there aren't very many rookies, no matter what their age, that you can say that about. So he gets my nod 1 month out. Tom, who's up for you?
Yeah, I love Cedric Coward. He was on my like fake big board, top five on my big board. I love him. And he's an older rookie, right? So he's 22. Yep. So you expect him to be a little bit more mature and a little bit stronger than your typical rookie. And he's very much exceeding expectations that I think a lot of people had Cedric Coward as like a really good prospect. But right away, like maybe the Memphis's best player this season, in that conversation, Jaren Jackson Jr. has been great, but like, dude's awesome. And national TV game Tuesday night, and he was the leading scorer on the team. Yeah, they're a little shorthanded, but Cedric Coward's, he's awesome. I'm going with another awesome guy. His first name starts with a C as well. Cooper Flagg, number one overall pick, Dallas Mavericks. You might have heard of him.
Yeah.
He's my rookie of the year. It feels like, you know, it took a little while for him to get his footing, and I think there's a reason for that. They abandoned this point guard, Cooper Flagg, not playing him with another point guard, and it really hurt his numbers in the early going, but now they're finally coming to their senses, Jason Kidd and the organization, after firing Nico Harrison, that they're going to play Cooper Flagg with Brandon Williams, D'Angelo Russell, or just a ball primary ball handler to make things easy for him. For the last five games, Cooper Flagg is averaging 18.8 points, 5.8 rebounds, 3.4 assists. He's been coming into his own, and it's not because he's like getting better or doing things differently. It's that they actually have a real roster around him, or at least a table setter that most players of his size will have next to him. Con Knipple's number two on my list. VJ Edgecombe from Philly is number three. Just to reiterate, Cooper Flagg, defensively, he's a monster. Offensively, he's, you know, had to deal with that like Jeremy Sochan experiment that Pop did a couple years ago, where they're just like, hey, why don't we just try out point guard Cooper Flagg? And since they've been basically playing him with Brandon Williams and other ball handlers, his effective field goal percentage with a point guard on the floor is 55%. Cooper Flagg, without a point guard on the floor, it's 34% effective field goal percentage. Oof. And effective field goal percentage actually is a boost if you're hitting three-point shots. So that's even lower if you just look at pure field goal percentage. So point guard Cooper Flagg, like when he has a point guard on the floor, 55% shooting effectively, 17 points every 75 possessions, according to PBPstats.com. With no point guard, Cooper Flagg is shooting 35% effectively, and then his points per 75 goes from 17 down to 13. Kind of helps to have an 18-year-old big having a point guard next to him. So Dan, that's I think the biggest reason why I have him is that he's 18 and producing these kind of numbers, and finally they got a point guard, and I think he's going to run away with this rookie of the year this year. He's been much better when they actually have a ball handler next to him.
No argument here. I had written about the point flag experiment, which I actually wrote about the point Sohan experiment a couple of years ago. Everything comes around for me early in the year with big, weird point guards. But Flagg's been sensational. When you get him off the ball and you let him run, you just see like the impact he gets to make when he's just downhill at the rim, as opposed to having to think through and make all the reads. He's looked sensational recently. Yeah, shouts out to Konkanipal. Leads all rookies, 17.6 points per game, 47, 40, 88 shooting. Played a huge role in Charlotte's like leap to respectability thus far. Ryan Kalkbrenner, the center that they drafted in the second round, been also huge for them in the other on the other end of it. He's second to Wembanyama in blocks per game. And so like he's been a real impactful at the rim defender there. VJ Edgecombe, as you mentioned. Will Richards been awesome in Golden State. Colin Murray-Boyles in Toronto. It's been like a really good rookie class. Now the New Orleans guys are playing really well now that they're out there and getting, I mean, things aren't great in New Orleans, but it's been fun to see Derek Queen and Jeremiah Fears go. So yeah, it's been a really, really rad rookie class. Those rankings might wind up shifting an awful lot over the course of the season, but no arguments here on Cooper Flagg except for the argument that I made before that. Number two, a little number this week, 8%. That's how much opponents' rim frequency drops when Victor Wembanyama is in the game, according to Cleaning the Glass. When Wemby's on the floor, Spurs opponents take 27.2% of their shots at the basket. When he's not on the floor, that goes up to 35.2%. That is the gap between like one of the stingiest, you keep you outside versus come on in, you know, the club is wide open for you, go right at the basket. In a related story, teammates or opponents' three-point frequency goes up by 8% when Wembanyama's on the floor. So it's very tidy. 8% down at the rim, 8% up from three-point range, because guess what? You don't want to go inside when the seven-foot whatever guy is in there. Opponents shoot 55.8% at the rim when he's in the game, up near 62% when he's out of it. He's just made an absolutely mammoth difference in the middle for that team. Leads the league in blocks per game and total blocks by a ton. Has the Spurs at third in defensive efficiency, despite all the young guys they play. It's a pretty rare thing to have a team that young be that great on defense. The calf strain might wind up knocking him out of DPOY eligibility for the full season. Hopefully not, but we'll see. But for right now, it has not done that. So he goes up at the top of my board.
Yeah, I've got Wemby too. I mean, the on-off numbers, 105 points allowed, every 100 possessions when he's on the floor, which would be right up against like the Oklahoma City Thunder is the best defense in the NBA, and it falls to 114. So 105 to 114, the difference between Wemby on the floor defensively and off the floor defensively. 43 blocks. Like you said, he's leading the league in blocks by a mile. To put that in perspective, Dan, that's more than the New Orleans Pelicans.
Oh, man, the Pelicans really didn't need to get kicked anymore, but here we are. It's right there to kick them. So.
Yeah. So Wemby has more blocks than in an entire roster, and he's missed a couple games here. So sorry to keep kicking him while they're down. Victor Wembanyama is my defensive player of the year. We got Cason Wallace and Isaiah Hartenstein on mine, and same for you. It's just like I guess a bunch of Thunder players fill out the ballot here because you know Cason Wallace has been awesome. Alex Caruso has been on the shelf for a while, and yet Cason Wallace is like, oh, I'll step in and be like the best wing defender in the NBA. And that is just a luxury that the Oklahoma City Thunder and their player development and draft selections, they can just like, oh yeah, no problem. AJ Mitchell. Sure. He'll be one of the go-to scorers for us when we don't have Jalen Williams. So great. But yeah, how did you do this? Did you just like write down names randomly and was like, yeah, I guess I'll go Cason Wallace here, or I could go Chet or Isaiah Hartenstein, any one of these, because they're by far the best defensive team in the NBA like they were last year. And it's hard to give like one guy the bulk of the credit.
Yeah, we had this conversation a little bit towards the end of last season where it's like, it's clearly that somebody here needs to be in the awards mix for them. And, you know, multiple guys need to be on the all defensive team from that roster. But it's such a group project. Like, how do you apportion credit? And what I did here was I look like just in terms of as you mentioned, all those guys in and out of the lineup, and Wallace has just played more minutes than any of their other perimeter guys outside of Shea, and has been awesome in them. You know, stepping up to the that sort of number one defensive stopper spot when Lu Dort's been out. Just like knife hands, like his deflections through the roof, steals are through the roof. He's such a menace to deal with, and the full court pressure that he brings. So Wallace felt like a sort of the like an emblematic player for what that defense has been like. And then, yeah, that's kind of a coin flip to me between the two big guys. What Hartenstein has played a lot more minutes than Chet, but the minutes that they've played when they're separated, when Hartenstein on, Holmgren off, 111 defensive rating. Holmgren on, Hartenstein off, 100 defensive rating. Wow. So that was kind of my coin flip there. Was like, it's a lot fewer minutes and the sample's a lot smaller, but when Chet's been on the court without Hartenstein, they have not missed a beat at all there. So again, no wrong answers as far as I'm concerned, as long as you're saluting a couple of guys from Oklahoma City. And just while we're here, shouts out to Amen Thompson, who remains an absolute menace at the point of attack for a top four defense in Houston. And then like, Rudy Gobert and Draymond Green, like it's boring, right? They've been around forever where, you know, there's fatigue associated with it. They are the, like, among, right up at the, at or near the top of the league in that on-court, off-court differential among defenders for teams that are both, like, near top 10 defenses that absolutely fall into a crater without them. So, like, Gobert, I think opponents are shooting something like 38% against Gobert at the rim. Draymond seems to be the only guy who's even, like, gotten in Wembanyama's kitchen individually as opposed to everybody swarming. They're still, you know, two of the best defenders of their generation, and you know, shouts out to them. Even if it feels like their moment has passed, they're still awesome when they're actually dialing it up.
Yeah, shouts to Beef Stew and Asar Thompson and Jalen Dern for that matter. Yeah. Just how good defensively the Pistons have been. I think they're second in the NBA in defensive rating. Just a note on this: Oklahoma City's lead on Detroit, the second place team in defensive rating, is the difference between the second place team and the 20th place team in defensive rating, the gap between those two. So like, what are we talking about here? Shouldn't it just be the Oklahoma City roster is like 1 through 5 on the ballot? But I digress. It's crazy. A train just rolled through, which is why my camera's shaking. Not rolled through my house, just rolled through the neighborhood. So there you go. Just wanted people to know everything's okay over here. The big number on the Richter scale is 0. There is no earthquake here. I just want to let you guys know.
Mine shakes a lot, but it's just because I type very furiously. So when I'm like looking something up or adding a note, you see like, it's not great. I'm sure it's a wonderful viewing experience for our folks on Yahoo Sports.tv and YouTube. Our third little number this week, 11.2. That's how many more points per game this season Ryan Rollins is averaging than he did last year for the Milwaukee Bucks. Ryan Rollins, he's a kind of like a bit part player for the first 3 years of his career. Really only got kind of a cup of coffee in Golden State and in Washington before he got to the Bucks. He played like 12 minutes for them. Last year, he got into the rotation, became somebody that Doc Rivers came to trust as a defender. Then Dame Lillard gets hurt. Then Dame Lillard is gone. You need a starting point guard. Doc Rivers was going to hand the keys to Kevin Porter Jr. He gets hurt. Ryan Rollins takes the keys, and now he's averaging 17.4 points per game, up from 6.2 last season, 5.3 assists per game, up from 1.9 last season. Obviously, the minutes are way up. That's part of the reason why, from 14.6 last year to 30.9. But he's playing playing lights out, super efficient, shooting 55% on two-pointers and 46% on threes, while taking 5 of them a game. He's getting to the rim. He's become a real great north-south driver for Milwaukee, a team that really needed another source of dribble penetration with alongside Giannis. And he's also, by the way, been one of the most disruptive defenders in the NBA, right outside the top 10 in steals, and leads the league in deflections. He's actually caught Dyson Daniels. Remember last year, Dyson Daniels was like head and shoulders above everybody in deflections per game? Rollins is right there with him now. So you're talking about a point of attack defender who's really disruptive, which the Bucks really, really needed, and someone that can take the ball out of Giannis's hands, that can create for himself or for others, and knock down shots efficiently. There are three kinds of guys, I think, that tend to win most improved player. There were guys who were like okay before, and now they look like all-stars. There were guys who were like almost all-stars before, and now they look like all NBA players or MVP ballot guys. And then there were guys who were like on the fringes of the league and now are starters and maybe like core players for their team. I think Ryan Rollins has been one of those through the first month of the season. And those other guys, they wind up getting all-star berths. They wind up getting all NBA selections. They wind up getting MVP consideration. These guys, this is the award for them. So here you go. Ryan Rollins, you get my vote a month into the season.
You know what? I couldn't have said it better myself. This award, I am giving it to Jalen Duren, and I kind of feel like you convinced me that this, the spirit of the award is the Ryan Rollins of the world. Right? Like that's, I mean, you're looking at a guy who's on a two-way contract last year and is now making $4 million, which is like nothing in today's cap structure, on the best deal in the league. I might argue Denny Avdija could be right there. He's number three on my ballot. But man, Jalen Duren's going to be an all-star this year. He's number one on my list right here that I've prepared. But now I kind of feel like I should copy you with Ryan Rollins. It's a great pick. I love watching this dude play at both ends of the floor. Yes, he's getting more minutes, which is why you're seeing a lot of his per game numbers jump off the page this year. But he's also improved, I would say. Not just a guy who's putting up, you know, filling up the box score because he's getting a lot of oxygen. He's a guy that's actually sharpened his game and being a go-to guy for Milwaukee, and they need it. So I've got Jalen Duren, Austin Reeves, and Denny Avdija, 1, 2, 3. And you've made such a compelling case for Ryan Rollins that I feel like I'm wrong here. I kind of want to move Ryan Rollins to number one, but I'll stick with this. Jalen Duren, here's a stat for you. Because, like, to your point, there's a guy who, you know, a solid player, but could be an all-star. That category, Jalen Duren is that guy.
Yeah.
Jalen Duren is that guy. Like, going from a role player to averaging 20 and 10 is a huge leap in the NBA. And a guy that I think for a lot of people, Cade Cunningham is the face of that team. He just got a signature shoe with Nike. And yet I think Jalen Duren might be the best player on that team this year. He's been so good both ends of the floor and filling it up in a way that I think is underappreciated. He's averaging 7 free throw attempts per game this year. He is 18th in made free throws, 73rd wow. last year. He's scoring on 80% of pick and roll as the roll man, 80% of the plays that he gets the ball as the roll man. He's like right here, lob threat. He's like the strongest dude in the NBA. Like, I think he might be stronger than Steven. I don't know if I want to go there. I don't want to pick a fight.
Whoa. Yeah. Yeah. I am. Slow down.
I just had to pump the brakes on that. You know, I don't want to antagonize Steven on that. But like, Dan, if you're going to pick a strongman competition in the NBA, like Jalen Duren's a top five pick. He is a beast. Like, he's so strong. They just have no choice but to foul him around the rim. And so now he's a guy who's getting 7 free throw attempts. And not because it's like a hack of a Duren. He's a good free throw shooter this year. So the leap that he's made.
It's the other way. Yeah, it's like I was just looking up because I wanted to make sure I was remembering it right. Their win over Atlanta on Tuesday night, the Pistons were up a couple of possessions late in that game. And so, you know, then Atlanta's trying to extend the game, play the foul game. And in that situation, when you're the team that's up, you're inbounding to like your best free throw shooter, right? You're like, that's where like Duncan Robinson comes in the game, or, you know, you get your designated 3-point, whatever. They were inbounding to Jalen Duren so that he could catch and get fouled and go to the line. In the final 26 seconds of that game, he goes to the line and makes 6 free throws. Like, they were intentionally saying, we trust you with the ball late in the game. We think that you're going to be the guy that we want step into the line there. That is a huge step for somebody who has been, you know, like no shortage of talent there and a lot of the potential. You're like, that guy's got something special and he could get there. You're seeing that in a huge way on the offensive end, obviously on the glass this year. The defensive area is where I think that that's been, you know, when you talk about specific improvements, he was like a kind of a defender you could take advantage of a little bit last year. Like the Knicks in that playoff series, they kind of wanted to have Jalen Duren in action in the pick and roll out up top. Or if you were able to get downhill at him at the rim, you felt like you had a decent shot, with how strong and athletic he is. Teams shot 63% against him at the basket last season. And now they're shooting, I think it's 55% against him at the basket this season. And like, you pair that with Isaiah Stewart, that is elite rim protection on. And that is a huge reason why Detroit is second in defensive efficiency. Like, young bigs is hard. It's really hard to learn how to play NBA defense. And he's still so young, but he's made that big leap while also jumping on the offensive end and, you know, with what he's doing on the glass. Yeah, if he winds up coming away, I think he's the favorite right now. If he winds up coming away with it, no shade here. And, you know, as you mentioned, Denny Avdija, fantastic. Austin Reeves looks like he's going to be on his way to a max deal. Like, there's a lot of really good choices here. Shout out to Keyon-A George. I thought he might be like out of Utah at this time last year, and he's now starting at point guard and, you know, shooting the lights out there. 23-7 per game. Like, that team is way more fun than I thought they were going to be. He's a big part of that. Yeah, there's a lot of deserving candidates here.
I hate to say this every year because it just feels like we're beating a dead horse. We need to remember how young these guys are when they're coming into
Absolutely.
The league. Absolutely. Keyon-A George, being a 20-year-old point guard thrown in the deep end, didn't look like an NBA player for a couple years, and then putting it together this season where he's averaging 23 a game and just took it to Portland earlier this season. And I'm like, this is what I was talking about with Scoot Henderson and other players being like, they're 19, they're 20 years old. Let's come back in a couple years and then let's evaluate their development. And not to say that we should just ignore the 19-year-old age 19 season or the 18 season. It's just like, let's wait a little bit. And Keyon-A George has been the poster child for that. That like lesson is, let's not write these guys off when they're 19, 20 years old. So yeah, he's putting it all together. No argument for me being on your ballot here. And Denny Abdia, Austin Reeves, these guys very, very much in the running for a first-time All-Star along with Jalen Duren. So shout out to those guys. Denny Abdia, like, averaging 25 a game, basically leading the league in and ones this season, and being the number one guy in drive passes per game for a team that needs kick-out actions. Portland has found their downhill driver, and no one can seem to stop them. You know, like, it's Denny Abdia has been awesome this year. Came on the second half of last year, putting up these types of numbers, and so it's kind of like a most improved halfway between the last year and this year. But a lot of times you see that in most improved player is just like a continuation of a great finish to the season last year. Denny Abdia, Austin Reeves are probably more in that category. Whereas Jalen Duren, I think, is just like leaps and bounds better than what he was at the end of last season. But Ryan Hollins, that's a great pick. What do you got for sixth man?
Yeah, our fourth and final little number this week is +21.4. That is the on-court, off-court swing for Jaime Jaquez Jr. with the Miami Heat. This season, when he's been on the floor, the Heat have outscored opponents by 11.8 points per 100. When he's been off the floor, they've been outscored by 9.6 points per 100. So you take that 11.8, you take that 9.6, you add it up, and you get 21.4. Here are the players that have had a bigger on-off swing among guys that have had at least 300 minutes played. So guys, you know, real rotation guys who played big minutes. Jokic, Aaron Gordon, who often plays with Jokic, Draymond Green, we just talked about, like, the defense falls off a cliff without him. OG Anunoby, who was sensational for the Knicks before he got injured, a hamstring injury. And also Nemish Keita, who's like the only center that Joe Mazzulla trusts in Boston, but he's also been good, you know, so, you know, fair enough. But like a handful of guys, big minute guys, have had a bigger on-court, off-court swing than Jaime Jaquez Jr. And it makes sense when you watch how fluid he seems and how confident he seems in that new Miami offense where it's no ball screens, all dribble drive. He has been sensational, isolating 14.2 drives per game, just outside the top 15 in the league. Perfect fit for that offense. And he's been really like I think he's been scoring super efficiently, been rebounding the ball, pushing, delivering those kind of driving kick-out passes you mentioned. He's one of 11 players in the NBA, averaging 17.6 rebounds and 5 assists a game. That is a list full of all-stars or guys who like have been all-stars or are like have a very good chance at being first-time all-stars. And Jaime Jaquez Jr., you know, you mentioned the sort of weight on it. He had a really rough sophomore slump. You know, everybody in Miami really like the Jimmy thing kind of tanked the whole season there and things didn't go super hot in Miami. He was he suffered from a lot of that sort of contextual damage. This season he has bounced back.
Yeah, it was a lost season.
He has bounced back in a major way and has been a driving force, like a literal and figurative driving force for what has made Miami so really surprising and impressive and maybe the most impactful reserve in the league thus far. At least that's the case I'm making right now.
Yeah, you know what? We agree on this one. He was number one on my ballot too. JG, Jeremy Grant, number two on mine, as well as Quentin Grimes filling out my top three for sixth man of the year. But no one's topping Triple J here. Or is it Triple Hay? Like, how is it Jaime Jaquez Jr.? So it's a hard J.
Yeah.
Right? So it's not Triple J.
Listen, call him whatever you want as long as you call him. I think that's that type of situation. Agree on Grimes. Yep. Here's a fun little number on Grimes. That three guard lineup, Maxey, VJ Edgecombe, Quentin Grimes, 176 minutes plus 81. They're blowing teams' doors off by about 21 points per 100 possessions, running up and down the floor at light speed, and they are scoring at a rate that would be like the number one offense in the league. So, you know, you think about big being beautiful in today's NBA, but this three-guard lineup has been like lights out for Philly. And just very quickly, sorry, Sandru Mamukelashvili. I had to say the name because I practiced it. I hope I did it right. The best bench in the NBA in terms of net rating is the Toronto Raptors bench. They're plus 4.9 per 100. The starters have, you know, get the awareness there with Brandon Ingram playing for them, and Scottie Barnes might be an all-star again this year. Emmanuel Quickley, RJ Barrett, those guys. The bench has been what's really driven the strong start for Toronto, and Mamu has really been like the unlocking piece of that, like this five out big who can attack the basket. He hammers the offensive glass and he really unlocks their second unit. I wanted to shout out the Raptors bench. And then if I had to pick one name to say, it would have been Sandro Mamukelashvili. So here we go. I wanted to make sure I said that.
You said
that.
Shout out. Can you shout it out? Can you like shout it for
Man,
us?
Man, my neighbors are going to love that. Sandro Mamukelashvili! I'm gonna get some complaints from the super, I think, in the apartment here. But that's, you know,
so
what? It's worth
confused.
It. It's worth it to celebrate our Georgian brethren out of Seton Hall, by the way.
You really shouted out. You did. That was a proper shout out. That
Sorry to our producers that had to listen to that and are gonna have to listen back to it. I apologize.
No, I guarantee you Sarah and Emmy are just giggling right now listening to this. So one last note on Jaime Jaquez Jr. He is top 10 in the NBA in points in the paint per game.
That's nuts.
He's coming off the bench, and it's like Giannis, it's Jokic, it's all these all-stars. And then there's the dude coming off the bench who had a really lost season last year. And shout out to Jaime Jaquez Jr. You could vote him for most improved. You can vote him for sixth man. And I wouldn't have a great argument against any of them. So number one on our ballot, Jaime Jaquez Jr. So shout out to him. And I won't scream it because we already did a number of that on your super. So Dan, that's it. That's it for the awards. That was really fun. Did I sway you on any of them, or the only swing vote that we got on this one was Ryan Rollins?
I mean, listen, you've made great cases. I think the SGA, frankly, I walked into this exercise thinking I was going to do SGA. And then I was like, you know, the Jokic numbers kind of went the other way for me. But we had that similar conversation last year. Like I wound up switching from Jokic to SGA later in the season, where it just felt like he's the leader, the driver of the main story of the best team, and the advanced numbers are like comparable, so why not? But Jokic just feels like has been so overwhelming at the beginning of the season. But then, yeah, I mean, like the flag argument of like this guy has had so much more to do and is 4 years younger, I think that's pretty compelling also. But listen, we've also got a long way to go. There's a lot of opportunities for these guys to, you know, show out and change our minds as we go along. So we'll have to, we'll see if we need to revisit this down the line, but I don't want to like assign us work we don't need to do just yet, but maybe it will be worth taking a look at this later on in the year.
A note on Cooper Flagg here. He's one of two rookies that is leading their team in the largest percentage of their clutch points. So there's two rookies who are leading their team in clutch points.
Hmm.
It's Cooper Flagg and his Duke teammate last year, Con Knipple, for the Charlotte Hornets. So
yeah,
they were on the same team. And as my Wake Forest jersey behind me shows, very happy to see that they didn't win the national championship, because go Deeks. But you know what? They can't say that too loud here in Charlotte, because it's not the super who's going to get mad at me. It's like the Charlotte, you know, residents are going to get mad at me, because like half the team is on is from Duke. Anyway. So we're going to talk about the injuries across the league and LeBron James coming back to rescue the league from a crisis, an injury crisis, right after the break. All right, Dan. So my latest at Yahoo Sports column I wrote this week came out on Tuesday, and I just saw on X it got over 1 million impressions because a lot of people seem to have an opinion about this subject, which is the injury crisis in the NBA. And I use crisis not haphazardly. I think it is a real problem that the NBA now have about 50% of its stars injured, too injured to play. And this has been something that's been brewing the last few years. And I think it's hopefully reaching a bottom point here, because this is something that I think fans, everybody, stakeholders, owners, GMs, coaches, we all have to figure this out, is how to get our guys healthier on the floor for the biggest moments, national TV games, non-national TV games. Right now, with 45 All-Stars and All-NBA players over the last three seasons, 45 players have reached either of those two teams over the last three seasons. Only 13 of them have played every game this season. Only 56% of them are playing right now. The other 44%, just about half, are too injured right now. Victor Wembanyama now out with a calf strain. Ja Morant, calf strain. Giannis Antetokounmpo, groin strain. Jalen Williams hasn't played. We all know about Damian Lillard, Tyrese Halliburton, Jason Tatum, Kyrie Irving haven't played this season yet. Paul George just came back. LeBron James just came back. But even last night, of the 17 stars in the NBA that could have played because their team was suiting up, only 10 of them actually played, so 59%. LeBron, we'll start here. LeBron was some good news that he came back Tuesday night in a win over the Utah Jazz and looked great. He had 12 assists, one turnover, just 11 points in his action, but it was very clear that LeBron James, his sciatica that was bothering him, he looked awesome last night, Dan. So good to see him back onto the floor for the Lakers. We'll talk about him in a minute, but first, your thoughts, Dan. Were you feeling this as someone who covers the league as closely as you do, is that you're doing a lot of writing about injuries this season?
Yeah, and checking in with our editors and saying, like, do we need a reaction column on this major player's injury? Like, it's become a nearly daily occurrence at this point. And I think the fact that we're seeing that so many of them are soft tissue injuries, right? We're talking about hamstrings, we're talking about calves, we're talking about groins, these sort of muscles where it's like, the start stop, the wear and tear put on them. It feels like it does feel like in the moment this is something of like it's like reached epidemic proportions. And I thought you contextualized in your story really well, you know, citing the research from Jeff Stotts at In Street Clothes, the invaluable injury resource, that like actually in terms of this season we're at a roughly similar pace in terms of games lost to injury and different injuries that we were at last year. The glass half full side is like, okay, so this is not an outlier. The glass half empty is, well, if this year and last year, like, we are trending in a direction that is potentially really, really negative, especially when you look at just the amount of work, frankly, a player's got to do this in this version of the NBA. And it's something we talked about on the Big Number during the NBA Finals, where like the mileage covered by the Thunder and the Pacers in that series and the speed at which they were covering it was just head and shoulders different than anything we'd seen at that juncture of the season before. And that's, again, at the end of like a 100-game season. And now what we came to in that is like, well, these two teams that are pressing full court, that are trying to push off of every, you know, miss, make, rebound, whatever, trying to play in transition as often as possible. Like, this is the blueprint for what successful modern basketball looks like. However, as teams follow that blueprint, like, it feels like it is pushing bodies toward a breaking point and doing it in an 82-game sample, which I think many people have argued for many years is too many games for what the intensity of the NBA game as it currently exists. And if you want to have the best chance of having more of those star players on the floor, you'd better have fewer games, which gets us to the argument of what happens if you reduce the inventory of available product, and do your TV partners like that? Do owners like that? Do players like that? The answer to that is all no, if it means you're making less money. And so we find ourselves in this push. Well, talk to me about that. Why do you ask that question?
Well, I think if we eliminated back-to-backs, right? If we got down to a number that we eliminate back-to-backs, it's not as simple as saying 20% fewer games, 20% loss in revenue, because I do think that if the NBA does this with a little bit of thought on this, they can make appointment viewing NBA nights in the same way that you have with the NFL, college football, and baseball is different because it's every night. But imagine a world in which you get rid of back-to-backs. Okay, you knock down the season enough that you get rid of these excuses to not play on a second night of a back-to-back, which for stars is medically, emotionally, all of this makes a lot of sense that you don't want to put yourself in the red zone, right? You don't want to do that where you could have a catastrophic injury because you're playing on the second night of a back-to-back. But what if we have like Tuesdays and Fridays every week we know your team is going to play? You know, like that would do so much, I think, for sports fans, knowing that every Tuesday, I know I'm going to watch the NBA. Every Friday, I know that my team is going to be playing. And so much of the NBA's just inventory problem, I think, is that most fans don't know when their team is playing. There's no rhythm to a season. Me, sure. When I'm doing Blazers games and I'm sitting down with my wife, like at dinner on Sunday nights, we have to like sit down and go, okay, the Blazers are playing on Tuesday this week, Wednesday, Friday, and Sunday. And then the following week, it's Monday, Wednesday, Thursday, Saturday. And that like that kind of randomness to the schedule, I think is in a way kind of like a dark ratings killer in the sense of like, I think a lot of fans, I think if they knew that the games were on Tuesday every week, Fridays every week, you'd see ratings go up because it's dependable and you need those kind of tent poles in your weekly schedule to build up, I think, a lot of that appointment viewing that the NBA lacks compared to college and college football and the NFL. And college basketball kind of has this. The NBA, I think, could use that. And so I think if you do go down to a 58-game schedule, I know that seems radical to some people. One home, one away. You play all 29 other teams. I think you can not only get a healthier league, but also get kind of the stakes back. So you get more healthy. You also get stakes in the games because there's fewer games and games matter more. And if you have Tuesdays and Fridays, I'm not smart enough to know whether ratings-wise we get Wednesdays and Sundays or what have you, but you get it down to two games a week and you make it so that you know every week you're going to watch your team play on Wednesdays and Fridays or Wednesdays and Sundays. I think that's a huge, huge advantage that the NBA, there's slack in the system. And I think that that could be a solution here is if we know that on two nights a week, I know that I'm going to get the NBA and then those other days off of the schedule, Dan, how cool would it be that we would talk about these games for 2 days at a time? Be like, hey, on Tuesday night, we're going to get Wemby against Giannis. And just like the NFL, we'll spend all of those days talking about that big matchup and building it up. Whereas now it's just kind of ephemeral. These games happen so quickly. It's hard to hold on to storylines and great games and talking about those great games either behind us or ahead of us because there's just so much inventory and so much whiplash in the schedule, it's hard to keep track of all of it. So that's my grand plan to fix all of this. Get it down to 58 games, make two nights, maybe three in the NBA's weekly schedule that you know your team's going to play. And I think you're going to see a bump in the ratings based on that alone.
Yeah, I can remember our pal Kevin Arnovitz making arguments about that, where it's like scarcity is there's a value to it. You know, if you're able to say, these games matter more because there are fewer of them, and you increase the likelihood that you're going to see who you want to see when you tune in for it or when you buy your ticket for it, there can be significant benefits to that. And like it will eventually, you know, could wind up even, you know, making you more money down the line. I think the idea of dropping to 58, I mean, people are, for whatever reason, there's part of it's the apples to apples comparisons of across eras and saying like, well, if all the records are on 82 games, then like, and then you drop to 150 or to 58, all of a sudden everything goes crazy. And like, there's one sort of traditionalist argument for that. There are arguments, but I think the main one is just you would need to basically guarantee to all of those stakeholders you are not going to see a short-term shortfall in your incoming revenue based on fewer gate receipts and based on less television inventory that you're selling to advertisers or whatever you're getting. Because I think as much as you can sell an argument for it's going to be a better product, if you're saying it will make you less money today, every person's going to be like, no, but I like having that pie that's the size it is right now. Yeah. You know, and like, and it's not just big bad owners that won't, you know, that are trying to grind the players into dust. I think it was The Athletic that did a player poll where they asked players, like, would you be in favor of a reduction in the schedule if it meant an associated reduction in salary? And like 85% of the players were like, no, absolutely not. That's leading the witness,
right? If you're saying I'm going to lose money, but what if the question was, if you could keep it, you wouldn't lose a paycheck. You'd keep your salary the same, but you're playing 20 fewer games. Now that would be an interesting question, right?
Yeah.
Would NBA players be like, no, more ball, better ball? Or would they say like, nah, man, my body can't handle 82. And if you can tell me that I'm going to make the same amount of money, but I'm going to be able to walk on my off days, great. Sign me up. You know, like, this is also a long-term issue, is if the schedule is going to be chewing these players, chewing them up, like, long-term, I just worry that we're going to see shorter, you know, career spans, and we're living in an age where it seems crazy to say that when KD and Steph and LeBron are still playing at the levels they are, but most players are not genetically and physically as gifted as them, right? And so, yeah, maybe it works if a lottery of lottery wins with LeBron. Yeah, maybe that will work with him, but for the 20 other All-Stars, like, can that work for them? So I would just say, it's something that the NBA needs to figure out. And I promised we would talk about LeBron here. So let's do, because it is kind of ironic that the guy who came back on November 18th, while everyone was missing games due to injury, is a guy who's about to celebrate his 41st birthday. So, like, at some point, we're not going to be able to go like, hey, LeBron, can you rescue us? LeBron, to the rescue. Here he is. And he makes his season debut, and he had 12 assists and looked every bit as good as he was last year. Like, obviously, there's some rust there. But what I noticed about LeBron's return from sciatica, he's operating a lot in the post. And he's spraying the ball around, and this kind of feels like old man LeBron, like 40-year-old LeBron, where he should be, is instead of trying to do this track meet that OKC and Indiana's trying to do, kind of feel like he's more comfortable in that, you know, let me catch on the elbow and run the offense with my back to the basket and give it to DA, who's rolling to the rim. Or I'm going to be able to play a little bit slower offensively, but I'm going to use my vision. Dude, he had 4 assists purely to DeAndre Ayton. DA got 4 buckets off of LeBron assists in the debut, and they had never played together. And there was a cool moment after the game where DA, after he caught a lob from LeBron, he said, you know, that's the second lob that I've gotten from you. And the other one was way back when at your camp when I was a kid.
Wow.
And that's awesome. Like, you love seeing that. And DA, he loves the ball in that pocket right into the free throw line. And LeBron already knows it. LeBron is so good at getting in the ball, not just in the shooting pocket, but also where you want to shoot it on the floor. And I thought LeBron was, man, he looked good, Dan. Like, after a month off of the season, he looked pretty damn good.
Maybe this goes to the argument that you're making. Yeah, give these guys longer periods of time off, and chances are they're going to look really good when they actually do get on the floor. I love the one, too, where it was like, LeBron takes the defender into the post, backs down, and just kind of turns around, flips the pass over his head because Ayton is on the opposite block just waiting for the lob. Dude. And finishes the dunk. And it's also funny because my brain goes, oh, cool, big, like, interior big-to-big passing. And I still don't totally associate LeBron as the big, but of course LeBron, yeah, it's like 6'9", 260.
He's Karl Malone size. We're so conditioned to think of him as a guard, we forget that he's 280, 6'8". Like, that's Karl Malone.
And he had 12 assists. I didn't look up the potential assist numbers for him, but there were a number of, even in the first, you know, couple of shifts he had, where he's passing to guys that didn't even know they were open. He saw it and was like, oh, if I get this to this guy, he's going to have an opportunity. And the guy's like, oh, crap. Like it's on me before he was ready for it. And so the idea that now you got, you know, those players are going to have two of those guys with Luka and him to be, make sure your hands are up because otherwise you might get clocked in the face or miss an opportunity for an easy bucket. I think that, rotationally, I thought it was interesting, to say you kind of give, like Luka will be able to, when you get into your staggers, it's like Luka and Jackson Hayes make sense to me where you got, that's the dive man for Luka, the lob threat. And then say, if you got Reeves and LeBron with DeAndre Ayton, as you mentioned, getting Ayton those looks in the pocket, getting him some more easy looks, it's going to kind of like balances out your offensive creation in a way that I think could wind up being really beneficial for those times when Luka's off the floor. Yeah, I mean, LeBron, I said this, I was on with the Golics, with Mike Golic and Mike Golic Jr. On Tuesday, and this could be an opportunity for, as you mentioned, old man LeBron to be a version of himself that we've kind of never really seen in the NBA, which is almost like the feeble LeBron, where he becomes kind of like the force multiplier, the security blanket underneath everything. If you don't need him to do quite as much creation on the ball, if you don't need him to do quite as much looking for his own shot, then all of a sudden, like the rebounding plays up, the facilitating plays up, the low man rotations where he's able to go, read the defense, read the offense, and go in and get a hand in a passing lane, kickstart a transition opportunity, cover for this guy if he's beat. LeBron's still capable of doing all of those things at a really high level, even this deep into his career. And needing him less and a lower usage role offensively could allow all those other things to play up. And if you get that, like, A-plus role player version of LeBron, not saying that he is a role player, but the idea of somebody who can contribute in all of those areas without needing to be the 25, 26, 27 point a game scorer, and you're able to keep his minutes down a little bit lower, I think that could be hugely beneficial for the Lakers, who have already been really good without him. So yeah, tons to like there in the early return. The fact that he was able to keep the double-digit scoring streak, which whatever it is now coming up on 1,300 career games, which is bonkers. That one might come down as the season goes along, or he just might wind up getting his wind, what did he say? He had like baby lungs, he felt like, as he was getting his wind back up. I don't imagine that's going to last for too long. And if he looks that good with the way Luka's been playing, with the way Reeves and Ayton have been playing, the Lakers get a lot more dangerous and a lot more interesting.
Yeah, I'll give you the stat you're talking about earlier. 20 potential assists in that game. Led all players last night in 20 potential assists, which, I always say, like, LeBron's the number one scorer in NBA history, and that's not even his best skill.
Yeah.
Where it's like, oh, yeah. And by the way, at age 40, I'm just going to be dropping 20 assists if they hit their shots. Last year through November, his time of possession with the Lakers, 5.5 minutes per game of possession time. In this game, he had 3 minutes, third on the team, time of possession, the ball in his hands, and he was still able to spray out 20 different potential assists. So definitely the ball's not in his hands as much. And I think, honestly, at this stage of his career, I feel like he finally might be okay with that. And if you got Luka and Austin Reeves, who LeBron is obviously president of the Austin Reeves fan club, I think that LeBron might be very comfortable in this role of third fiddle. Doesn't sound right, but honestly, if the numbers shake out that way, I think like that might be best for LeBron and their ability to have, a deep postseason run if he's not having to do everything. So,
I mean, why not limit his workload, extend his career another 3, 4, 5 years? What the hell? Why not? I mean, to look this good in year 23 at age 40, almost 41. Yeah, let's see how far we can take this. I don't know. Every year you go year to year on the contract gets you a little bit closer to the down payment on the Vegas franchise, Bron. So, what the hell? Why not?
Yeah. And, since he's a G League player now, he's got multiple avenues to extend his streak, coming up from the G League.
That social graphic of the smiling picture of LeBron with G League on the bottom, I was like, that's brutal. I know we're doing these things for engagement, but that was brutal.
Hey, you know what? You don't get mad when guys go on rehab assignments in Major League Baseball, go to the minor league. So you know what? It's no big deal. That's going to do it for us. I think that was, that we hit about just about every team in the league, I think. Shout out to Cam Thomas,
Sure. Yegor Dioman. Shouts out to Yegor Dioman and also sure. Michael Porter Jr. Playing like a guy who wants to really put some tape out there for people to know he's available. And doing it big for the Brooklyn Nets.
Available like in trade talks. Okay, so here we go. That's gonna do it for us today. Thanks to Sarah and Emmy and the entire squad that works behind the scenes on the show. Please watch The Big Number on YouTube. Hit that subscribe button. Give us a 5-star rating wherever you listen to our show, wherever you get your podcast. Please leave us that rating and give us a review. Tell your friends. Tell everybody about this show. Appreciate you. We'll be back again next week. And until then. Enjoy all of the stars coming back from injury. I'm going to just speak it into existence that we get healthier stars in the league and we can talk about them doing awesome things. Thanks so much, everyone. Have a great weekend.